to go back once again, back to the place where no one wears a frown, to see once more those super special, just plain folks in my hometown. No fella could ignore the little girl next door. She sure looked sweet in her first evening gown. Now there's a charge for what she used to give for free in my hometown. I remember Dan, the druggist on the corner. He was never mean or ornery, he was swell. He killed his mother-in-law and ground her up real well, and sprinkled just a bit over each banana split. The guy that taught us math, who never took a bath, acquired a certain measure of renown. And after school he sold the most amazing pictures in my hometown. That fellow was no fool who taught our Sunday school, and neither was our kindly Parson Brown. We're recording tonight, so I'll have to leave this line out. In my hometown, I remember Sam. He was the village idiot, and though it seems a pity it was so, he loved to burn down houses just to watch the glow. And nothing could be done because he was the mayor's son, the guy that took a knife and monogrammed his wife, then dropped her in the pond and watched her drown. Oh yes, indeed, the people there are just plain folks in my hometown.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Elizabeth Loftus, who's an American cognitive psychologist and expert on human memory. She's best known for her groundbreaking work on false memories.
I'm not sure people know how fierce the ensuing memory wars in psychology became. Norterre, who was she the clinician who testified in that case?
Yes.
Okay, one of her claims was that what we know about trauma is that the more often a person is traumatized, the more repetitions of the traumatic experience, the more likely it is that they will repress the memory, which on the face of it would seem preposterous, since no one ever repressed the memory of the Holocaust or of being in a concentration camp for 7 years and so forth. But those claims, those clinical claims, came to anchor one end of the memory wars as against what scientists were discovering about repression and trauma. Would you tell us something about how the APA report or the effort to come out with a position paper on recovered memories and
the growing
tension between therapists and scientists?
I should say that it is therapists and scientists, but what happened with the American Psychological Association is they put together a committee of three clinicians and three researchers to study this issue and to try to come up with a consensus report. And we ended up, after several years of meetings, with two separate reports. Reports and then replies and then replies to the reply. And I don't think it did much to resolve the issue. And there still are these tensions, although there has been, I think, a sea change. I think people are now finally coming to see that, you know, there really isn't any credible scientific support for these claims that are being used to prosecute innocent people and or to sue them in civil court.
Well, do you find continuing belief in repressed memory? Are there continuing cases today of people claiming that they've uncovered a memory from their childhoods and so forth?
Yes. The public doesn't see it that much because the media covered it so intensely and for so long that it has to be a really famous person being accused or a really famous person doing the accusing or a really large amount of money for it to get into the news again. But there are a smattering of these cases, and they're still clinicians who are testifying on behalf of these accusers who are trying to say that there is support for repression and that we all know repression exists.
Could you give us some examples of the kinds of charges, the kinds of memories that were turning up in these trials? Some of them were so outrageous and so preposterous on the face of it that it seemed so unlikely anybody could believe these were actual experiences. Do you recall any of them? Would you like to give
us an example? First of all, after the actress Roseanne came out in 1991 claiming that her mother had molested her when she was 6 months old and that her father joined in to commit further molestations when Roseanne was older, you started to see other people come forward and say, I was molested when I was 6 months old, and they'd produce these detailed memories of the experience. So I was involved in court cases where people were being sued or accused of having committed crimes on somebody else when the somebody was 6 months old. So we in psychology know that there is this concept of childhood amnesia, that as adults we don't have concrete, trustworthy, reliable memories for things that occurred in the first couple of years of life. Jurors and judges are having to listen to these claims. Then you had claims of years and years of brutalization, ostensibly banished into the unconscious by repression or some similar mechanism. Then you had these unbelievable claims of being victimized in satanic rituals, subjected to animal sacrifice and baby breeding and baby sacrifice, the works, all allegedly repressed into the unconscious. People had to sit through lengthy, expensive court proceedings based on those kinds of accusations. It was wild out there.
It was wild out there. It's true. Yes. Well, it was what we in social psychology would call a moral panic. It was a national panic. You put the word sex and children in the same sentence, and people seemed to lose their brain cells and at least their ability to think of what it was like for them when they were children or what children are like. Sexual curiosity became evidence of molestation and. So it was really tough times. I remember that when you won the APS's William James Award 10 years ago, your research was at a high point and your emotional life was at something of a low point. I think in great measure because of the Jane Doe case that was such a horrific experience for you of being sued by this young woman. I mention this because when someone like you receives awards, and when it seems so obvious that your science and your awards are so worthy, I think people don't often realize the emotional price that it can take when you're at the same time being sued and your university is not supporting you. So what are your thoughts now about the Jane Doe story and how that unfolded?
Oh, gee. Well, just to remind you of a little bit of background, I had read this case history. It was a psychiatrist was putting out this case history of a woman named Jane Doe. He called her Jane Doe. I called her Jane Doe. And she had accused her mother of sexual abuse. And then, according to the psychiatrist, she repressed the memory, and then it came back 11 years later. And he captured it on videotape. So he was going around to professional meetings showing his Exhibit A, the new proof of repression. I was seeing this case history being introduced into court cases in the prosecution of people I believed were innocent. And yet, how are you going to find these people? How are you going to get to the bottom of it? It's a case history. He controls all the information. 300 million people in America, how are we going to find the Doe family? And one summer, I set out to find them, and I did. And once I found them, I enlisted the help of a colleague, poor Mel Geyer. He had no idea what was going to be coming. But in any event, he was very helpful. And we actually, once we found the accused mother, this is a mommy did it case, and she was unbelievably grateful that somebody finally believed that maybe she was innocent. We went and met her. We went through every page of the court records. And we were getting ready to write an expose of this case because we don't believe that any abuse actually happened. An expose. And Jane Doe complained to my former university. And with 15 minutes notice, they came to my office and seized my files and gagged me and put me, so I wasn't allowed to talk about the case, and put me under investigation for suspected wrongdoing.
What was the nature of her complaint? That you committed an ethical violation investigating her? What?
It started with an email complaint. One of your faculty's looking into my life, and I'm upset.
Okay.
And then it you know, morphed into, you know, feeling her privacy was invaded. And so the university took 2 years to finally decide I did not deliberately violate human subjects regulations when I went off to meet the accused mother or to talk to other individuals. Some months after that, I was still unhappy about it. They didn't adequately apologize for what I had gone through and the amount of money I had to spend on my own attorneys. So I took a job at the University of California, Irvine, where I got a great job offer, was going to put this behind me, not think about Jane Doe anymore, got the expose published, put the case to rest, stop it from being used against other people, and that's when Jane Doe sued. Should I mention she sued you, too?
You can. You have.
Okay.
This is what happens. You hang out with her. You just...
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, you know, so we... Mel Geyer and I wrote the expose, and we thank Carol in a footnote for her help with the article. Poor Carol. Be careful who you thank. In any event, so there we were, we three, sued for invasion of privacy, defamation, and other claims.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be nervous, Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination. Men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, all at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. Where? Waist deep, big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
The wonderful thing is that nobody knew her name until she named herself in the lawsuit.
Right.
My invasion of my privacy has been invaded. I, who was writing this for Skeptical Inquirer with you, I didn't know her name, but we invaded her privacy. There you are. So it was a very, it's always, of course, distressing to be sued, but it was also a terribly sad, sad story of a young woman unable to give up this account of her life and to give up her memories, and that's what is indeed so devastating. And so what has become of Jane Doe today?
Well, Jane Doe, first of all, the lawsuit dragged on for maybe 4 or 5 years. It went all the way through the California Supreme Court. In the end, I managed to settle out for a nuisance fee. The other defendants, including you, went after her for their attorney's fees. Those defendants were awarded $250,000, and Jane Doe declared bankruptcy.
Let's move on to another topic that really interests me. You've been, because of this work, of course, an expert witness or a consultant in hundreds and hundreds of cases, many of them very high profile. I've just made some notes here. The Hillside Strangler, Oliver North, the officers accused in the Rodney King beating, the Menendez brothers, the Bosnian War trials in The Hague, the Oklahoma bomber, Timothy McVeigh, and litigation involving, is this impressive or what? Michael Jackson, Martha Stewart, Scooter Libby, and the Duke University lacrosse players. So of this astonishing assortment, are any of these cases something that you learned something about in particular that you'd like to share with us or tell us about?
Oh, well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, the more meaningful cases, I think, for me are when I have played some role or some small role in helping to bring justice to an innocent person. But many of those people are people you haven't heard of. Mm-hmm. But they just happen to get on the wrong side of some bizarre accusation. And if I can play some role in helping them, that's what feels really good. Mm-hmm. But I do have to say that it has been kind of interesting to meet some of these notorious people along the way. So meeting Timothy McVeigh, for example, in prison. He was in prison. This was pre-trial, and his lawyers wanted me to meet him. And I do remember walking into this little prison room where he was with a lawyer and a guard and so on, and him saying, "Tell me about yourself, Beth." And I went, "Whoa, I feel like Jodie Foster here." And you know,
why?
From you know, Hannibal Lecter. I said, I study memory, and there are some interesting memory issues in your case. He was accused of renting the Ryder truck and John Doe number two was with him, and everyone was looking for John Doe number two. Turns out there was no John Doe number two. That was a memory mistake on the part of witnesses. But so I'm trying to explain to him that I'm a memory, and I said, you know, maybe I should send you one of my books, Witness for the Defense. And he said, "I don't really read books." And I said, "Well, this is an easy book." I said, "As a matter of fact, John Gotti, USA Today, published the 10 books that John Gotti had in his cell with him, and my book was one of them." And so I said, "That was really good for sales." And McVeigh says to me, "Send me your book. I'll let people know I'm reading it. Maybe it'll help your sales." So that somebody could do what he almost certainly did and was executed for, and still have that kind of thought. It was just an interesting irony.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. But so, Beth, this is very interesting, because much of your work has been defending, as you say, people whom you believe to be innocent, who were falsely accused in these horrific recovered memory cases where miscarriages of justice almost certainly have happened. But do you make a distinction when someone who is almost certainly guilty calls upon your expertise as a memory scientist to come to their defense? And how, by the way, would you distinguish scientifically between taking on the case of a client who wants to use the "I just don't remember" excuse to get away with murder or other shenanigans, you know, as opposed to they really don't remember?
Well, I think in the beginning of my career, I used to think, well, science is there for everyone. If somebody needs it and wants the scientific information to be brought into their case, that they have a right to do that, just like they have a right to an attorney or any of the other rights that we have. And so I wasn't really very much thinking about did they do it or didn't they. I was just looking to see, are there factors here, psychological factors about which there's a science and we have something to say, and if so, I'll go and say it. At this point in my career, because I have so many opportunities and so little time, I would rather be working on a case where I really feel there's a high probability that they're innocent. So I do try to make my own decision about that and then step into the case.
Good. Okay, let's turn now to some of the pro-social memory work that you've been doing in recent years, the Alan Alda experiment, for example. Would you please describe for us this idea of implanting beneficial memories? How would you describe this work?
Well, okay. So I had done all this work on distorting memory for events that actually did happen. And then the more recent work on planting entire memories into the minds of people for things that didn't happen. And some years ago, with my collaborators, postdoc and graduate students, we decided we wanted to look at the consequences of having a false memory. If I plant a false memory in you, does it have repercussions? Does it affect your later thinking, your later intentions, your later behavior? And we decided to do that by making people believe that they got sick eating a particular food. So at this point, I wasn't planning on doing good for the world. I was just wanted to be able to plant a memory, you got sick eating a particular food, and then see if people would tell you they don't want to eat that food anymore. An example of demonstrating consequences of having a false memory. Well, we showed this with hard-boiled eggs and dill pickles. Then we did it with a fattening food. And once we did it with a fattening food, that's when I thought, you know, we could be on the brink of a dieting technique here. I wasn't planning to go in the direction of diets, but now if you could just plant this memory, make people believe they got sick and they avoid these fattening foods, we also showed you can plant a warm, fuzzy memory about a healthy food, and people want to eat that food more.
Broccoli?
It was asparagus, but broccoli figures into the story, but it, asparagus in the study. So, why not? And it was funny because once I started to speak about this work, of course, the therapists can't do this. They can't take this scientific information and run with it because they're not allowed to use deception with their patients, even if it's for their own good. But I argued to people who were interviewing me about the work, well, there's nothing to stop a parent from trying out some of these techniques on, you know, their overweight or obese teenager or child. Hey-o.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.